My name is Mika, and I am an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA, and since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Phil and Dino, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and our understanding. Diane will read the preamble.
Hi, I'm Diane. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. It does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Terry will read the steps.
Hi, my name's Terry. I'm an alcoholic. These are the steps. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry the message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Gina will read the traditions.
Hi, I'm Gina. I'm an alcoholic. 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those who they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Kate.
Good evening. Hi, I'm Kate. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
guys. Wow. It's a big room. It's a big room. let's see, stats. My sober date is May 20th of this year. I have a sponsor as a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I am a member of the Atlantic group. That's my home group. This is my home group. You're my home group. Let's see. I'm sure I'm forgetting something. Oh, I've gone through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a delightful experience. I highly recommend it. I continue to go through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm in no way finished, because that would just be sad. I want to speak not so much about myself, but I'm sure there are people in this room who are uncomfortable, who are sad and angry and in pain and writhing. And I totally identify with you. I don't know you, but I think I know how you feel, and I think everybody in this room does too. So if you're here, congratulations. You've walked into a room full of love and possibility, and you really couldn't be surrounded by finer people. That's just my experience. And I also wanted to say that I recommend getting a sponsor as quickly as humanly possible. It changed my life. It changes my life every day. And more than that, it changes me every day. I have a sponsor and a sober family. And the women in my sober family are inspiring and inspired every day. And I look to them for grace and dignity. And hopefully it rubs off a little bit. I stated that I'm an alcoholic, and that's very true. I didn't think it was, but it's not so important when you first come in that you think you're an alcoholic. It really isn't. That may not be for you to know right now. It certainly wasn't for me to know for a long time, and it's not important if somebody else thinks you're an alcoholic, or if you think you are and nobody else does. It's been my experience that that going through the 12 steps reveals a world of who you really are and what you're capable of, and it is only through a power that is greater than me, infinitely greater than me, that I am able to show up for my life today and try every day to be a better person. And that was a long journey, although I can't say that it hasn't been really full of beauty and grace. At the, I was going to say at the height of my drinking, I should say at the depths of my drinking, I could never get enough, and I was always hurting, and I was like, really? Is this what it's supposed to feel like? I couldn't seem to summon the strength to be serene. And I looked to a drink every night, especially if it was pretty or smelled really good, or if I was in good company or bad company, or just my company, which goes without saying what kind of company that was. I was convinced that if I could just get a little bit of relief, that everything would be fine and my problems would be solved and that I could just take care of it. That I could just make everything okay. Yeah, it turns out that doesn't work. And I tried really hard at that for a long time. I am independent. I used to be bossy. I'm really not that bossy anymore. But I like things the way I like them. I'm an alcoholic. And when I came to this program, for some reason, I was supplied, I believe, surely by a power greater than myself, because it was not of me, to be willing. And I started taking directions. I'm not really a directions person. I'm one of those kids who when they give you that test and it says, you know, fill this out, and if you read to the end of the directions, it says, if you've read to the end of the directions, you know that you're not supposed to touch anything on this page, and then you'll get 100. I was the person who read the first direction and was like, I can ace this. Turned it in, failed. But that was in the eighth grade, and thank you, I've forgotten that now. My life in sobriety has been short but beautiful. I don't hurt people anymore. And before, if you'd asked me, I would have said, no, I don't hurt people. I'm a generous, loving person. I really am. Can you pass me the bottle of wine now? And I guess I have an emotional balance because every day I start out and I pray, and I have to admit the chief fundamental truth of my life, and that is that I can't run things for myself, and it's such a relief. I have to surrender every day, and that really used to scare me. I have a higher power now that is growing, and I saw glimpses of it as a child, and I had a very loving family, still do, and many blessings. But it's through this program that I have been able to learn what spiritual fitness is. I can have conversations and not react. I don't have to argue anymore. And I used to love to argue. I really did. And I also, my grand sponsor says to me very regularly, you know, it's not about thoughts. Your thinking is not going to get you where you need to be. It's about actions. And every action can be taken on its own, the next right action. But I don't come up with the right actions on my own. I just don't. I tried that for a while, and I ended up here with you lovely people. So what I have to say about taking the right actions is that I talk to people. I call my sponsor every day. And I have gradually become able to, hopefully, to be an asset to those around me, and to be of service. I love this meeting. I love Atlantic Group, and my life has really begun again here. And the basic thing about being an alcoholic is that I have a trifold problem that doesn't go away just because I come to a meeting every day. I have a physical reaction to alcohol that makes me want more of it. It's called a craving. It doesn't happen if you're not an alcoholic. You can have one drink and be completely content. That wasn't me. It wasn't me about anything. I also have a mental obsession, so between a drink on Wednesday and a drink on Thursday, I'm thinking about the drink between Wednesday and Thursday. I've got to get myself to it. I've got to get through whatever is there to get me through it. And really, the overarching deficiency is a spiritual one. And that's the one that I think may be hardest to fill. And I wouldn't be able to if I did not have direction. And I had to find a higher power that I believed in me, that wasn't the worst voice in my head, that wasn't the one that was condemning me. I had to find a higher power that I understood. That's all you need. That's ground zero in here. You need a higher power that you understand and that you believe, or can come to believe, can unconditionally love you. That's where everything starts. And I found that higher power by working the steps, by listening to my sponsor. I found a God that knows me and that loves me and that overrules me, and that I let myself be overruled by. Today I live in the present. Thanks. I try to be a comfort, and I find myself comforted through no real action of my own. I don't have a heavy load anymore. I don't walk through my days feeling pain. And that was unimaginable to me when I used to drink. And I can't really say that there's anything that I miss from drinking. because I couldn't figure out how to live. I couldn't figure out how people were walking around and not hurting without faking the smile on their face. Now I don't have to, and it's a beautiful day, and I try and take care of my side of the street, and I really couldn't be more grateful to be here and to be with all of you. You guys have become my anchor, and it's a privilege. So thank you very much, and keep coming back.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Luis.
Good night. My name is Luis, and I'm an alcoholic. It's so great to be here and see so many familiar faces. Vince, Peggy, Michael, Stacy, I mean, Rajesh, so many faces that are dear to me. But it's also great to see so many new faces. And I've been away since the last time I spoke here for a year, and a little bit more since I moved back to Mexico. But just how this group has the ability to attract people is something that that is really incredible. And the reason why this group and this room is always full is because there is a solution here. And I was very lucky to move to New York in 2005 and to come in my first months to this group as I was trying to get myself sober, and I have been trying to get myself sober for quite some time, for many years. I think of the 20-something years I drank, probably half of it I dedicated to trying to control my drinking or to stop drinking. I think from the very first time I tried alcohol, it had an effect on me that I've heard in these groups people share similar things that normal people don't feel. And it gave me a sense of comfort. It gave me a sense of fitting in. And I think I shared last year how I have the tapes of AG in my car, and I listened to you guys, and I was listening to someone, and it struck me that this person, she was sharing about her father being an alcoholic and how she swore she wouldn't become like her father. And I identified completely with that, because growing up, I mean, and don't get me wrong, my father is one of the people that I admire most and that I love most, and we're very close, but he was drinking very heavily, and it was a profound sense of grief for me. And growing up, I didn't want to become like him. And I ended up drinking like him inexplicably. And it wasn't until that morning driving that I reflected on it. And I mean, it's just so involuntary the way we live our life and where alcohol takes us. If you're new, you're very lucky. You're not only in one of the best cities to get to work the steps and get to learn about AA and to practice this this program, but you're also in a very solid group, a group that follows traditions, a group that has a structure, where you will hear many times the medicine that you need to hear. You will hear, get a sponsor, do service, pray, and all of these things that ultimately, in my experience, help us to stop thinking for a minute about our little self and our problems. I visited Atlanta recently, and I went to the Martin Luther King Center, and there were two phrases that that impressed me, and I sent an email to my sponsor, Stacy, with them to share them immediately. I copied them. There wasn't a card or a poster with them, but one talked about service, and it said, everybody can be great, because anyone can serve. You don't need a college degree to serve. You don't need to put your verb and your noun together to serve. All you need to do is to have a compassion and a loving heart and a heart full of grace. And I heard when I came to this group, Peggy, say that we arrive here as hotshots and we graduate into servants. And I didn't quite get it. I thought, these people are weird. I'm never going to fit in here. And if this is the only solution for me, then it's going to be a tough road ahead. And really, I mean, service has the ability to allow you to stop thinking about your little problems or your big problems and starting to become someone useful to others. And the other phrase that impressed me greatly said that the great question in life was that you had to choose between altruism or selfishness. And that was what determined the judgment of life. And the question was, what are you doing for others? And those things, I mean, I could never have understood if I hadn't had the luck to be an alcoholic, to arrive in this room, to meet my sponsor, to work the steps, and to understand that whatever my problems are, everything that I suffer, that I went through my alcoholism, through my experience, will help me to understand and to help someone identify and trust me, and trust that I am an alcoholic, that I am someone that has the same problems that he has, then I can share with him, I mean, what I did to get sober. Just very quickly, I had the consequences early on. I lost friends, alienated myself, and that didn't matter. I had many groups of friends, so I moved from one group, if the doors closed, to another. And few people knew how much I drank, because I tended to leave places just inexplicably and without even paying the bill or maybe paying it, but I went to another place and to another place, and only I knew how grave the situation was until my life became unmanageable and problems piled up in a way where I lived with terror, with fear. I thought that everybody was trying to bring me down. I heard a phrase of Henry Kissinger that said that even paranoids can have enemies. But I really thought that people were trying to bring me down at work. And now, recently, reading with Stacy before this meeting, we were reading to the employers, and now I don't care about what the guy in the cubicle next to me is thinking about me, because I'm more concerned with taking the call of a sponsee, returning the call of a sponsee, or doing something other than thinking about myself and my problems, and that is a true gift that I got here. It's great to be back. I mean, this is a very happy moment for me to see you all and to share with you. I've been in AA in Mexico, and there is a vibrant movement. We had the luck in the group, my home group now, which is Grupo Prado Norte, to start a big book meeting. And the group is growing. It's growing slowly but surely. And the reason is because there's a solution. And I'm sponsoring people, and I'm seeing now one of my sponsees has a sponsee. So it's this chain of life that continues to extend beyond us. And I find myself caring for these people so much that when my sponsee is not there and I see his sponsee, I walk to him to ask him how he's feeling. I take him to dinner. I care about what he feels. And I identify so much with how we all suffer in the first year during the time we're working the steps. And we don't know where this is going to take us. But I encourage you, if you're new, to stay here, to get a sponsor, to do service, to pray, learn how to pray, because prayer, as Peggy told me once, prayer changes everything. And if you don't know what the prayer wheel is, ask Peggy, ask someone here in this group, and start doing it. And I promise you that your life will get better and that you will become someone that can be of service and useful to others. And that's something great. And I'm so happy to be here, and I thank you all.
And our main speaker tonight is Jessica.
Hi, I'm Jessica. I'm an alcoholic. And as soon as someone starts adjusting my microphone, my ego just starts to inflate. My sponsor told me that humility is not a requirement for membership, and that's a good thing because I would definitely not be here. I wanted to kill myself every day, but I was insulted when I was counting days if you at the Atlantic Group didn't ask me to speak. It was like this crazy, crazy dichotomy. And mostly, I really just want to take just a moment of silence to ask for the strength to tell the truth, to help one person here, and not to swear. I'm going to make this a little lower if I can. Maybe you can do it. My sobriety date is May 11, 1994. I should first say what an honor it is to be at the Atlantic Group. I have such deep respect for this meeting. I have such deep respect for my friends who are in this meeting. I've seen people who cannot get sober, and they come here after years and years of trying to get sober outside. I don't know what it is you're doing, but you're doing something right. So just God bless the Atlantic Group. I really, really appreciate what you've done for so many people I know who basically have gone everywhere else and have not been able to get sober. My home group is NYU. I want to give a shout out and thank everyone from my home group who showed up today. When I walked in the room today, I was just so delighted to see you. I've certainly had my hardships over the last, you know, over the last 15 years of my sobriety, but I've been with NYU for about 5 years, and they've seen me through some really, really hard times. And, you know, for me, it's all about sharing honestly, and I share very, very honestly with my sponsor, I share honestly with my sponsees, and I share honestly with my home group about what's going on. I usually don't raise my hand to say how great life is in sobriety. You can see that in my eyes. You can see the light in my eyes. You know I have a good life. But I really tend to share about how do I get through the difficult times. And when I leave a meeting, usually things that I remember is the person who's having the most difficult time, who has that willingness to share honestly to stay sober. So I was so excited to speak here. I could hardly sleep last night. I blow-dried my hair. You would think that I was going to prom with George Clooney. I was so excited. And if you're new and think I'm a loser, I know exactly how you feel. This is not a club I wanted to be a member of. This was the last stop on the train. I wanted to be any place other than Alcoholics Anonymous, and quite frankly, I came here because I had no place else to go. And when I came here, I did not raise my hand and say I was an alcoholic. I had that tradition in my mind that said the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. I didn't have to think I was an alcoholic. I didn't have to believe in God. So I'd raise my hand and say, I'm Jessica, I have 10 days, and I want to kill myself. And my home group would give me a standing ovation. And that's the reason I came back, is they accepted me just as I was, and I was a friggin' wreck. I was passing the open windows. I went to 3 meetings a day. I was a constant burning desire. I called my sponsor sometimes 10, 15 times a day. I had 90 sponsors in 90 days. I was really willing to go to any length. So if you're new and you're really uncomfortable about the sponsorship thing, get online. Most of us have no idea how to have a true partnership with another human being, and sponsorship is the first step in that. But what I did, and my sponsor always told me this, the sponsor I have today, that I had this willingness, so that even though I would get a sponsor and then realize that, you know, what a loser they were, and I'd go to the next one, I had that willingness to at least go to the next one. And it was when I was counting days, I didn't say I was an alcoholic. I must have had 30-some-odd days, and I would still talk about when to kill myself all the time. And this woman, Julie M., took my number, and I'm so indebted to her. I did not call her. She called me to check in on me. And she's the same sponsor that I have today at 15 years. And I'd love to say that, like, she became my sponsor, and suddenly I was on a pink cloud, and I loved her, and she loved me, and I loved the suggestion she gave me. I couldn't stand her, and it was like chewing glass, like every time I thought about a suggestion that she gave me. But I had that willingness to do it, because I had no other choice. My life was not only unmanageable, it was unbearable. And I was really willing to do whatever she told me to do. Now, I was told that if you don't have resentment against your sponsor, you need a new sponsor. She was constantly telling me the truth about myself, and it was incredibly hard to hear. You know, when we do the steps later on, there are three kinds of lies that we have to face. And it's, one's the outright lie. You look beautiful when I'm in curlers and a mess. There's the lie of omission, where I just don't say something. And then there's the lie of delusion. For me, that leads the procession of my dishonesty. So delusional when I came in here. And like it says in our literature, you know, those who are incapable of being honest, those are the people that can't get it. Now, I must have like this chink in the wall because I kept coming back here. I was still probably 99% delusional, but I had like 1% clarity that maybe this place could help me. And I want to talk about, you know, why I'm here. I'm an alcoholic. I'm definitely an alcoholic. It's amazing that I didn't know this when I was counting days. And if you're new and you don't think you're an alcoholic, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. As Scott R. says, stay around long enough to get a diagnosis. And you'll see that if the cure works, you have the disease. So I came to AA, and I should really tell you where I've come from before I came to AA. I started drinking when I was in grade school. I wish I could tell you the exact first time I had a drink. I probably fourth grade, spin the bottle behind the school, warm beers. Probably. But quite frankly, I was very interested in alcohol. And quite frankly, by the time I had my first drink, I needed it. I came out of the womb an alcoholic. I was discontented. I was so uncomfortable in my own skin. I remember thinking in second grade, I had this anxiety about how I could never be a mother because I'm so insane. I knew I was insane. I never connected the dots that alcohol had anything to do with it. But I do remember when I started to drink, that ease and comfort that it talks about in our book. That's what I got. And quite frankly, if I could have that ease and comfort that I had at that first drink, I would still be drinking. But that's what I chased for so, so long. And, you know, I could bore you with a lot of love of drunk stories. I mean, basically, by the time I was in sixth grade, I was pretty much every single weekend getting severely drunk, blackouts, you know, bed spins, throwing up, waking up on people's driveway with the, you know, cement imprinted on my face. Kind of the highlight drunk story, which was, you know, I'm not very proud to say it. I had an older sister who's amazingly non-alcoholic, because there are so many of us in my family. She used to invite guys over, and for some reason, they always end up in my room hanging out with me. So I don't know how I did it. You know, suddenly the delusion now, I realized that I was always looking for attention, and that was one of the amends I had to make later in sobriety. But I must have been in like middle school, and they were 4 years older than me, and he said, just sneak out the back, we'll take you out to clubs. And I must have been like 12 or 13 years old. I went and met like, I don't know, like seven guys that were much older than me, went to the city, got incredibly drunk, blacked out on the way home. I think I threw up like on all of them in the car. I mean, gross. And then I was being hosed off by someone's mother in the morning. And then I walk into my house, my parents' house, and my mother's like, where have you been? I said, I was at Karen's house. She goes, I called Karen. We had the police looking after you. Where have you been? I said, just leave me alone. And I just walked right past her. And that kind of alcoholic arrogance, it was like constant. My poor parents. I would basically drink regularly on the weekends, and I'd come home. I'd always forget my keys or lose them. I'd come home at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'd ring the doorbell, and they wouldn't answer. And I'd ring the doorbell. And then I'd throw stones at my parents' window. And finally, they would like, I'd hear the window come up. And they'd throw down the keys. And they'd be like, what took you so long? That kind of like alcoholic arrogance, it was part of my life. And like I said, I really believe I was an alcoholic when I came out of the womb. You know, I have this very self-centered mind that is different from the normal person. I know this because I'm married to a normal person. We are different. He was watching. My husband and my kids are crazy Yankee fans, crazy Yankee fans. So, of course, they're watching the game last night, and I am so involved in my work, I don't even, like, know what's going on. And in the morning, I was like, so, honey, they didn't do that good. He's like, no. I said, so they didn't make it to the World Series? He's like, it was the World Series! Like, this is like the nucleus of the men in my life's life. So it just goes to show you, I have a long, long way to go. You know, back into how I got into recovery, Basically, just more awful stories like that. I basically had an ID when I was in sixth grade. I used to go to bars. I would dress up. And, you know, being a female alcoholic at a young age is a really, really frightening thing. You know, you basically will do anything to get your drinks. And I put myself in a lot of really awful, dangerous situations, and a lot of awful things happened to me. And, you know, at the time, the alcoholic life was the only normal one. I thought it was normal to do those things and end up in those places. And now that I have children, I'm sober, I think, God forbid that happened to my child. But again, I thought it was the only normal life. And basically, I had a little chemistry set. I would get drunk. I would pass out. I would black out. I'd wake up, and I'd have the Visine, and the Alka-Seltzer were in the water, and I'd go running. I'd be like, I am powerful over alcohol. I actually thought that I could drink anything, and I was powerful over alcohol because I had this little chemistry set. And again, it went on like this, and it's interesting. When I tried to stop drinking, it was like whack-a-mole. You know, I'd whack down the drinking, and like an eating disorder would pop up, and I'd whack that down, and suddenly I've had these obsessive relationships, and I'd whack that down. It was just like around and around and around and around. So finally, I was always being sent to the school doctor, psychiatrist. I was in therapy literally in fourth grade. You know, I'm from the Jews. Like, that's what we believe in. If there's a problem, go to therapy. And... you know, it's amazing that I saw all of these specialists and never talked about my drinking, and I didn't get better. So I finally saw this psychiatrist who sent me to this woman for an eating disorders group, and I sat down with her, and she starts taking an inventory of my drinking, and I was like, what are you doing? I said, I'm here for the eating disorder. She goes, if you join this group for eating disorders, you can't drink. And I was livid. I could not believe that this doctor sent me this woman. I said, you don't understand, I don't have that problem. And she starts asking me when the last time I had blacked out was. And I said, I'm going to be honest with you. The last time I blacked out was probably middle school. I drank all the time then, but I don't drink like that today. And she said, oh, well, we're out of time, but why don't you come back next week? She was not going to let me into this eating disorders group. I had to stop drinking. That was the requirement. So the day before, or a couple days before I was supposed to go back to her, I got photos sent to me in the mail. And I opened these photos, and they were of a party I had been to on the West Coast. And I didn't remember one photo that was taken. And I looked at the photos, and I began to put together that night, which was a typical night, like so many other nights that I had. There was me. There was a drug dealer. There was a drug dealer's girlfriend. There was me trying to take the drug dealer's girlfriend away from the drug. I mean, it's just like a typical night out that I had no idea about. And I had to, like, that was so typical of me and my girlfriends. We would go out, and I'd ask them what I did. Like, blacking out was such a normal part of my story. But I really thought, again, this honesty, I was so delusional. I really, when I told that psychiatrist, I thought, and I was 26 at the time, I really believed the last time I blacked out was when I was 13. And that was the chink in the wall of my armor. That was the denial. That was the little bit of light that shone through. And I knew what I had to do. My father was an Alcoholics Anonymous 7-some-odd years before I came. And I watched his life, and my sister was also an Alcoholics Anonymous. I watched their lives get better as my life got worse. And I knew if I wanted to stop drinking that this is the place I had to go. But let me tell you, this is the last place I wanted to go. I remembered how I judged them for being an AA, how I thought they were Moonies. My father had this little stained glass serenity prayer above his mantle. I was like, we're Jewish. That is like so goy. Like, why? What are you doing? And I was like, we're mentally ill. We're not alcoholics. We're mentally ill. Like, I was so sure of it. And the truth is, I have a lot of problems other than alcoholism. But if I drink, my problems are going to have puppies. So it's really, really important that I don't drink. So basically, I started counting days in Alcoholics Anonymous, and like I said, I was like the person you didn't want to sit next to. I was so anxious. I was a constant burning desire. If I didn't call on, I was a constant resentment. It was just like this just insane asylum, like all in one human being. And it was amazing. People were so nice to me, so welcoming, and that's why I came back. There was no judgment of me. People didn't tell me I had to say I was an alcoholic. People didn't say I had to believe in God. And especially my sponsor, she's like, well, just work the steps. It doesn't matter what you believe in. So as we started working the steps, you know, the first step, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. You know, the alcoholic life was still the only normal one to me. I didn't see the unmanageability. So she had me write out my history, basically in bulleted forms of all the times that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. And then I had it in black and white. It was like the great American novel, you know, starting off in like fourth grade. Because every single time I drank to get drunk, and my life became unmanageable. And I, you know, my mind is like only thinking of that first drink, is only thinking of the ease and comfort. So I never played out the tape. So it was really helpful to do that first step and actually play out the tape. I did come in on the second step. I knew I was insane. I had no doubt about it. I did have faith that AA could restore my sanity because I saw what it did to my other family members. And, you know, in terms of that third step, you know, turning I will over to a higher power, I was like, Julie, I just can't do this God stuff. She's like, you don't have to do it. I said, well, what should I do? I mean, people are telling me to get down on my knees and to pray. She's like, I don't really believe in God. She goes, it's okay. Just fake it. And I said, oh, I can do that. You know, I had been lying to people all my life. Inside, I wanted to kill myself, and I thought I was less than, and I wanted to kill you. And on the outside, I was kind of popular, and people liked me. So it was like this crazy dichotomy. So when she said, fake it, I started getting down on my knees in the morning, and I said, you know, God, please help me stay sober. And at night, I said, thank you for keeping me sober. And in terms of the fifth step, you know, I know people have these great experiences with the fifth step. They get together with their sponsor, and they unload all this pain and suffering. And for me, I got together with my sponsor. I had my novel of resentments. I was really good at the first and second column. You know, I'm resentful at blank, and this is the reason why. Had no idea what my part was in it. And she said, don't worry, we'll do that together. So I get together with her, and I start reading it. She's like, well, we can go to the last column. And I said, what do you mean? She goes, Jessica, you call me like 10 or 15 times a day. I know the first and second column. We don't have to do that one. And I was so insulted. And I basically stayed there for like an hour, and she left me with a list of defects. I was shocked. Like, the top of the list was demanding. I was shocked. And I honestly tell you, I left that fifth step with no idea what my defects were. And I say this because I always think the sixth step is shortchanged. It is my favorite step of all the steps. If there was a theme song for it, it would be Getting to Know You. Because I honestly had no idea how these defects played in my life. And so she told me, with this short list, to pick a defect a day. And every time it came up, to say, ha, 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 there I go doing that again. Or, if I didn't do something, but I was thinking in a resentful way, ha, 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 there I go thinking that again. And it was so enlightening. It was the first time that I actually got to know myself. And I just, again, I'm so indebted to Julie. What's kind of funny is I did work the steps with her, and around 5 years or 6 years, I can't even remember, I'm a very demanding girl. Like, I decided that she wasn't giving me enough, so I ended up just not working with her for 5 more years. So if you're like, have time, and you're having problems with sponsorship, or, you know, it's like this true partnership with another human being. We're really, really bad at it. And so this woman who literally saved my life, she called me when all I could think about was wanting to kill myself. And I decided 5 years that she wasn't giving me enough. And the truth is, I found another sponsor in AA, and I learned a lot from that sponsor. But, you know, I'm happy to say, like, around 10 years, I went back to Julie, and she's a huge, huge part of my life, and I was able to make a formal amends to her, because it was so obvious how resentful I was all the time, and towards her, towards the person that, like, literally gave me the program. So a little bit about sponsorship. You know, I sponsor people, I have a sponsor, I do service in my home group. At many times in my sobriety, I had more than one sponsor. And during my first 5 years of sobriety, I had a second sponsor, and his name was Eddie McGrath. And I heard Eddie McGrath speak this one time, and I was so moved. He was like a walking 11th step. He had this serenity, he had 20-some-odd years of sobriety, and he had a humility about him. Plus, he was really funny. So I basically went up to him and I said, Eddie, I'd like your number. And he looked at me and he goes, on one condition. And I said, okay. You have to know, I'm never going to try to sleep with you. I was like, oh my God, this wrinkly little Irish man is telling me this. And the truth was, it was such a powerful thing to say. Because like I said, a female alcoholic drinking at an early age, I was in a very, very messed up situations that really screwed with me. And, you know, also growing up in some ways with alcoholics, other alcoholics, my father being an alcoholic and a drug addict, it's like sometimes it's like being brought up by wolves. I mean, you just really don't learn how to have a relationship. And I got to tell you, before I got sober, I had a terrible relationship with my father. And quite frankly, 10 years into sobriety, terrible relationship with my father. The best I could do was pray for him and stay away from him. I was so terrified, so uncomfortable, so much bad history from the house I grew up in. And, you know, Eddie transformed how to have a true... He taught me how to have this true partnership. And he didn't do it by telling me what to do or telling me to work a step or telling me to write a gratitude list. Every time I called him, and sometimes I called him 5 times a day, two sponsors called them each sometimes 5 times a day. So if you think you're burdening your sponsor, let me tell you, I'm sure they've done it to someone else. So, you know, freely, they owe you to freely give what was freely given them. So I took real advantage of both my sponsors, and every single time I called Eddie, no matter what it was, usually I was hysterical about something or resentful about something or angry about something or felt rejected about something, and he said, be still. Nothing else. Every single time I called him. And, you know, that's pretty much the most important thing that anyone's ever told me in sobriety, because if I can be still, that's when a power greater than myself can come in my life. Now, I say it as if it's so easy. If you're new, it's like you're this gerbil on the gerbil wheel. It's so hard to get off. You're lucky if you're breathing. You know, I would go see doctors. They're like, stop talking, start breathing. I was so anxious. But yeah, Eddie was amazing. And when I had about seven years of sobriety, in the same month, he passed away with one of my best friends in sobriety. And, you know, my heart just broke open. And someone in my home group always says, in AA, when your heart breaks, it breaks open. That, you know, we are able to make it through these seemingly unbearable situations. And not only do we get through it, but our experience will actually benefit others. And I've learned that over and over. I'd love to tell you that, like, I've had this, like, golden happy road of sobriety. I've gone through some very, very difficult things, as have every single person sitting here. And, again, sharing honestly about what's going on is what's helped me over and over again. Hope. I definitely want to talk about hope. I've certainly told you that I was like a dark night before I got sober and way into sobriety. I had not a pink cloud, but a black cloud, and it didn't last 90 days, and it didn't last a year. It got a little grayer 2 years, 3 years, but it was a dark cloud like the first 5 years. It was really, really, really rough for me. Luckily, I had these great sponsors that guided me. And I remember after I had a year of sobriety, I was so excited. I was like so ready to get in a relationship. And I said to Julie, okay, let's go. I'm ready. And she looks at me and she goes, I suggest you take another 6 months. And I was so pissed. It was like another one of these suggestions I did not want to take. And then she reminded me what I was like when I was counting days. And actually I had to change my home group because I became obsessed with a crack addict that came in. Like newcomers, like I was not even allowed to go to coffee with them if they were straight. I had to stay really far away. I was looking for this partnership, but it wasn't true. And I was looking for it all the time. So basically, a year and a half, it's like, okay, I'm ready to start dating. And I learned about the ding. And I was told that if I go to a party and across the room, I see the one ding, I should turn around and run in the opposite direction. That my instincts had never served me well, and that my judgment was extremely poor. I was told that if I would have gone out with someone if they had a pulse. That's the kind of judgment that I had when dating. And it was true. It was true. You gave me attention. I wanted to get together with you. And it was as simple as that. And I put myself in a lot of dangerous situations. And I learned in sober dating that, you know, at the end of the date, you say goodbye, you close the door, you're on one side of the door, they're another. It's like... Never knew that before. I had no boundaries whatsoever. I learned how to eat 3 meals a day in sobriety through HALT. Don't get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. And I could say if you're new, like if you do nothing else today, if you breathe and eat 3 meals a day, God bless you. That is going to help get you through the day without picking up a drink. So many good things have happened to me in sobriety. I can't even begin to name them. I mean, I... so many good things. I mean, I think probably the best thing that's happened to me is that I had a cabaret show, again, with the courage of sobriety, and I ended up meeting my husband through the show. His mother came to the show and whipped out a photo of him after the show and said, "You have to meet my son. He's athletic, 2 Ivy League degrees. He speaks Spanish. He's living in Costa Rica." She knows I do human rights work and I'm really into South America. I'm like, "Barbara, he has a girlfriend." She's showing me a picture of him and his girlfriend on the beach in Costa Rica. And she's like, "It's not going to last." So 6 months later, he calls me. And by the time he called me, I was so tired of sober dating. I was so tired. I was just like kissing a lot of frogs. And he called me on the phone. I spoke to him for like 5 minutes. I hung up the phone. I called my best friend, my sponsor, my sister. I said, "I'm going to marry this guy." And you can imagine the first date. Going to meet the man I think I'm going to marry and not being able to drink. I mean, it was the most painful, awful date I'd ever been on. I kept just saying, "I'm not usually like this. I'm usually very charming. I usually talk a lot." I just had nothing to say. And I knew he was not going to go out with me again. I actually had to send him flowers and, like, beg him for another date. But, you know, like, the things we have to go through in sobriety, like, oh, it's hard not having a social lubricant, you know? It's hard. It's hard going through a death of someone you love and not drinking. It's hard having heartache. And I need to talk about heartache a little bit because, as I told you, like, one of the best things that happened to me in sobriety is finding this true partner. And before we got married, we went to Las Vegas on a vacation, and I said, "I'm going to go to a meeting." I said, "It's open if you want to go." He's like, "Oh, sure." And I was like, "Oh." Like, I didn't really mean for him to say that. But he was like, I was like, "Okay." So we went to this meeting in a hotel, and it wasn't that big. It was like 8 people. And someone shared, and afterwards said, "Does anyone want to share?" And my husband raises his hand at this Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. My husband has like a beer and a half a week. He's like totally not an alcoholic. So he raises his hand, and he said, "I just want to thank this group and thank Alcoholics Anonymous for giving me my wife's life back." And he's never seen me drink. I was 5 years sober. It's like, how does he know the power of Alcoholics Anonymous? But he clearly does. He clearly does. He sees the service I do. He sees how important it is for me. He sees when I'm snarky and he suggests that I go to a meeting that I'm better after. I mean, he knows the program works. He knows the program works, and he knows the light in my eyes has very little to do with me, but has to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. You gave me back my life. And if I get nothing more in Alcoholics Anonymous than being able to cross the street without wishing a car would run me over, that's enough. I don't need anything else. I don't need the husband. I don't need my beautiful children. I don't need anything else. It so happens if you stay sober and you work the steps, other good things do happen. I'm kind of running out of time, and I want to talk about bad ideas. I have a lot of bad ideas in sobriety. I kind of like to call it my lower power. I'd love to tell you that I don't have, you know, obsessions, you know, but for me, like I told you, this is a disease of whack-a-mole for me. I could be a 12-step junkie. I could be in every room, probably besides Clutterers Anonymous. I basically have this traveling circus, and so, you know, I can be on the beam, but as soon as things get a little rocky, I have this, like, obsession that I'm just trying to land someplace for ease and comfort. So my foster sister passed away 2 years ago from this disease. She was homeless in L.A. She died on basically under a bridge in L.A. And we tried to get sober. Like, she tried to get sober a number of times. And I used to go out there every year and to take her to rehab. And she really wanted it. And, like, I don't really believe that, well, I'm working it so I get Alcoholics Anonymous. I get to stay sober today. I believe it's grace. Like, God bless you if you're coming back for the 10th time or the 20th time or the 15th time. Eddie McGrath told me that some people are on the 20-year program. You might not get it right now, but you're going to get it. Just keep coming. And if you don't get it, it's no fault. We should all be dead. Nobody should be in this room. I shouldn't see any of these pretty shiny faces, you know? So it really is grace. And if you're sitting here, you know, I don't like to tell people to be grateful, but we should be a little grateful. We shouldn't be here. I shouldn't be here. So my bad idea du jour, I should say of the year, was my sister died, and suddenly I felt entitled to find the girl who understands. Do you know that part in the big book? It talks about that distraction, like having an affair for ease and comfort. Like, I felt entitled to have it. I didn't connect it at all to my sister's death. Now, from sharing in my home group about my struggle with this, they helped me not take an action on it. They actually listened to me. They said they identified with me, and they got me through it. They got me through it. And like I said before, you know, in AA, sometimes it was like I really thought my heart was going to break open if I didn't get what I wanted, this girl that understands, a boy that understands, whoever that understands. For some people, it's cheesecake. For some people, you know, again, once we take away the alcohol, it can travel to a lot of different things. And through sharing honestly at NYU and with my sponsor and with my sponsees, I was able to get through that and deal with the real feelings that I had about my sister dying of this disease. I'm out of time. I just want to say one thing, which is that my name is Jessica M. NYU is my home group. We meet 5 days a week, 12:30 and 2. I'd love to see you there. I chair the beginners meeting. You can reach me. I want to give my phone number out because I know there's no time to talk to anyone afterwards. You can definitely talk to me at NYU if you need help. My number is 718-875-0058. Again, 718-875-0058. I have a lot of friends at the Atlantic Group. You can get my number through them. And thank you so much, the Atlantic Group, for letting me speak.